today. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yoda. We're here with Craig Smith. You can reach Craig at buygold.com. As a matter of fact, if you just type in buygold.com into your browser, not only do you come to Craig Smith's company, Swiss America, but if you click on the knowledge link at the top of the page, there's a pull-down menu that has access to free resources and everything you need to know to be able to verify that what Craig is saying on today's program is factually accurate, you can do. Say, there was something that the president said that during the on the news segment during our break, Craig, that I wanted to ask you about. He said that he was designing his budget so that it ignites the great engine of our economy, which he said was the middle class. You know, and I thought that the engine of our economy was business operating within a system of modestly regulated and modestly taxed free enterprise.
It is. I mean, so once again, the president is grossly misguided. And look, what a joke. I mean, forgive me for being disrespectful. I'm not going to be disrespectful to the president, but I will be to Mr. Obama, because he has put forth two budgets, which he should have put forth many, many more, all of which were voted down in the Senate 99-0. He never even got one of his own party to vote for his ridiculous budgets, because they do exactly what you just said. They try and focus on the middle class, which sounds like a wonderful thing to do, but at the expense of business, who creates the jobs for middle class.
Right. The engine that enables us to have a middle class is business operating within a free enterprise system. And when you go to war against business and you eliminate all of the incentives of free enterprise, which our government is doing, you no longer have a middle class.
That's exactly right.
He's missed the entire flow that goes from business, tax, modestly taxed, modestly regulated free enterprise system, creates all of these things, including a prosperous economy.
That's right. And look at it, Yada. No matter what the issue is, whether it's the debt, whether it's immigration, whether it's gun control, he always targets the companies. The other day I heard one of his cronies, you know, one of his spokespeople say, well, if we're going to get the immigration on track, we have to punish the corporations
right. That
hire these illegals. If you talk about debt, we have to punish those corporations for going offshore. No. Become conducive to those corporations, create an environment in which those corporations can prosper and hire people, and you will be the envy of the world again.
Now, here's a man that the majority of those Americans who voted in the last election sided with him, a man who has never held a job in private industry in his entire life, and they said, in essence, that we agree with his strategy, which is to demonize business, which is the only hope for an economic survival of America, and it is the very thing that creates the middle class.
That's right. And do you remember years ago, Yada, when Lee Iacocca did the famous turnaround in Chrysler?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody said, gosh, we need a man like that to be our president. We had a shot at that with Mitt Romney. We really did.
From an economic point of view, it was the clearest election. I don't like Mitt Romney any more than I like most politicians, but this was an election which should have been based entirely on the economy, because America is failing economically. And you had the clearest choice between I've done it and I've been successful and I've never even participated in the economy and I've failed at everything I have proposed thus far. Those were your choices, and America voted in favor of the nincompoop.
Yeah, and what's funny about it is because he was yucking it up with Jay Leno and Pimp with a Limp and all these people versus saying, look, what we need is a CEO to run the country. Look, I didn't expect Barack Obama to bail out graciously, but we needed – in that interview with Mitt Romney yesterday, I was so struck, Yada, because he said, gosh, I had an 87% Democratic Congress in Massachusetts. It forced me to get people together and make things happen. Can you imagine if the president tomorrow called everybody into the White House and said, look, we're going to bring pizzas in and Pepsis, and we're not going to leave this room until we come up with something. We're going to work together. We're going to put America first and politics second. This president only thinks in political terms, and you
Correct.
Know as well as I do, Donna, good economics are always bad politics, and good politics are always bad economics, because you're always taking from one to give to another. And you said something at the beginning of the first hour that struck me. You said that, you know, we've demonized big banks and blamed them for the crisis, when in fact it was government policy that created the crisis, not the banks. But it reminded me of a quote that Ayn Rand had in Atlas Shrugged, and it bears repeating. She said, money is the barometer of a society's virtue. When you see that trading is done, not by consent, but by compulsion, when you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from the men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods but in favors, the politicians, when you see that men get richer by graft and pull them by get richer by graft and by pull than by work, and your laws don't protect you against them but protect them against you, when you see corruption being rewarded and honesty becoming a self-sacrifice, you may know that your society is doomed. And these politicians played favors to put money in people's hands that would then in turn finance their political campaigns to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars. And Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged got it right. When we as business people need the permission of men that have never even held a job like Barack Obama, we are doomed, Yada.
Yeah. Yeah, what you just read from Atlas Shrugged is like holding a mirror up to present-day America. And the gist of that is that if you continue to burden those who are productive to the point that there's no longer any incentive for them to bear the burden of pulling the cart forward, because you have put so many burdens in their cart, they stop pulling. And when they stop pulling, because everyone else has become dependent upon what they produce, everything fails. And that's when Atlas shrugs. We have a caller. Wayne is calling in from Texas. Craig, he has a question for you about silver. Would you mind taking that call?
Sure.
Go ahead, Wayne.
Hello, Yada. From 2005 to 2009, I was buying gold eagles until I read about the 1933 conservation, where they took the gold away. Anyway. Mm-hmm. What I did, I had a chance to double my money, so I sold my gold and started buying silver eagles.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have a little over 200 pounds of silver eagles. And being a smaller trading medium, I was wondering if it was more beneficial for silver than gold.
What's your view of that, Craig?
Well, you know, I'm a traditionalist on this, Yada, and it's a wonderful way to go, but silver is more of an industrial metal than a precious metal. And gold has always been seen as money, as a monetary metal. That's why we had a gold standard. Matter of fact, when we went to a bimetal system, gold and silver, it didn't work as well as when we were strictly on a gold standard. Silver will be a wonderful proxy for gold. It has done better than gold in recent years, but it is a highly volatile market. So subsequently, you can see substantial increases, but you can also see substantial decreases. Gold for the last 3 years has been rather boring. Let's admit it. It's virtually done nothing. But I'm not so concerned about the return on my money as I am about the return of my money. And so I stay away from areas that I think are speculative, and I do think that silver is speculative right now. As it relates to having a smaller amount, Wayne is absolutely right. If you have 1 ounce of silver, you can trade one coin in for $30, $35 versus 1 ounce of gold that may be $1,500. But you can also get around that in having fractional 10th ounce, quarter ounce, half ounce coins. But no, silver's done very well. It will continue to do well. I've heard comments that silver could go well over $100 an ounce. But once again, I've seen so many fits and starts in the silver market. I was here in 79, 80 when the Hunt brothers tried to control it, and it's just a little bit too speculative for my blood. I stay with a monetary metal like gold.
Wayne, the answer that Craig gave you has happened to be the answer that Scott and I, my producer, talked about in the break. He spoke of the same thing, and my answer was almost identical. I think there is an advantage of having, however, and I'm not an expert on this, so I'm not giving you economic advice. Craig Smith is, so I'm just speaking to you as a friend, not as an expert on this. But I think there is some value for the reason that you stated in having a small. A smaller slice of your savings in silver.
Because it's very smart.
Yeah, because if the government tries to pull the FDR standard again and tries to confiscate your gold, at least having some of your savings in silver is a way to be able to buy, sell, and trade in that kind of a confiscatory economy. But as an investment, it's not as safe.
Let me address that real quick about the confiscation, because I'm not particularly concerned about a confiscation, because there's certain products you can buy that are non-confiscatable under the Coinage Act of 1933. But that being said, with $18.1 trillion of paper sitting there, it's a lot easier for them to grab by pushing a couple buttons on a computer than it is to go through the physical act of people having to turn gold in. I have an 84-year-old customer that remembers the day when he was a young man, little toddler, when the government came to his father's farm in Ohio and took his gold and handed him paper. And then they shut the banks down for 3 days. It destroyed his family. It literally put them out on the street. And this man buys one thing only. He buys gold. He's had it for 80. He still lives in the same house he was raised in 84 years ago. He doesn't trust his government as far as you could throw him. And I think he's one of the wisest men I've ever met.
Yeah, well, what I was looking at was a smaller medium, you know, for local barter or something like that.
Yeah, see, I don't think we're going to ever get to that stage, though. There's always been what's called a currency of acceptability that has come onto the scene. When Russia fell, it was the U.S. dollar. When Israel, when the shekel got in trouble, it became other currencies in the region until they put the new shekel in place. So I fully expect that when we see the devaluation of the dollar and say it's replaced with the SDRs from the IMF, then you'll just take your gold and exchange it for the new currency. I don't think we're going to have a barter system. I think we're way too advanced for that. We're always going to have a medium of exchange, and that medium of exchange is always going to be what's going to be most convenient, which traditionally would be paper or credit cards, quite frankly.
Yeah, I'm convinced that Craig, you're right here. What I think is going to happen is that the dollar is going to become valueless, but the exchange currency will be something out of the International Monetary Fund, and that people who are in debt will be induced to accept the new form of exchange for forgiveness of debt, because debt at that point, the money that the debt is registered in will be worthless, and so it will be the mechanism that is used to control us financially. This is back to Shattering Myths. For those of you who enjoy the second hour of our program more than the first hour, we'll be focused on Yaz's creative testimony. I apologize for going 20 minutes into this hour. For those who enjoy Craig Smith and the insights that he is providing as a guest, then I'm glad we did so. Craig will be back again on another program. He is remarkably insightful. The reason that I decided to go along with Craig this morning was the fact that he provides evidence that underscores why Yahweh asked us as the first requirement for participating in his covenant to walk away from our country. If you are dependent upon your country, whether it be America or the UK or France or Australia or New Zealand, no matter where you live, Canada, if you are dependent upon your country, then not only are you disqualified in your present status from participating in the covenant, but in addition to that, you need to know that there's a reason that God asked us to walk away from our country, to walk away from the Babylonian influences in our world. And yes, the biggest part of it is that Yahweh wants us to trust and rely upon him rather than on human institutions. And yes, I understand that is the biggest part of it. But there's more to it than that. God knows that we humans have a tendency politically, religiously, patriotically, economically, militaristically to create institutions that purport to be trustworthy, that by their design are conceived to cause people to be dependent upon them, so that those in positions of power and influence over those institutions are enriched and they are empowered. And so there is a great deal to why God asked us to walk away from our country. And I think that it would be hard to find a more articulate, more knowledgeable, more reasonable spokesperson on the current state of America financially, and much of the world is in a very similar plight. Now, turning back to Yah's creative account, we were analyzing at the end of our program on Friday, we were analyzing the 6,000-year epics that are spoken of throughout the creation account, with the two most important of those creative epics being the one revealed on the fourth day and the other the seventh day when God rested. While each of those creative days, and we are now through the fourth as it relates to reading Yahweh's testimony, speak of something extraordinarily important in terms of human history, from the time that Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden to the time that we return to living in the Garden of Eden, where the entire earth is created in the image of the Garden of Eden, and we live with Yahweh here on this planet in the kind of close personal relationship that was actually experienced in the Garden of Eden. The fourth day is the time where God said that the greater light would be seen to us as a sign, and that sign would be of the Moed, which is specifically what Yahusha came to enable, came to fulfill at the last year of the fourth millennia of humankind. Now, if you don't get from that the fact that Yahusha, in year 33 CE, which is year 4000 Yah, exactly 4000 Yah years from the time that Adam and Chawa left the garden, to him fulfilling as the greater light, the greater illuminary, the first four Moed, the Mikre, at that time. If you see that just as, well, that's kind of an interesting coincidence, then your mind doesn't work like mine. I love connections like this that just scream out to you and said, I have a plan. This is my plan. I am enabling and fulfilling my plan just as I have promised. On the fourth millennia of human history, year 4000 Yah, 33 CE in our pagan calendars, the Messiah Yahusha walked into Jerusalem 4 days before Passover and fulfilled, right on schedule, in year 4000 Yah, Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavua. And in so doing, God enabled each of the five benefits of the covenant. And for anyone who observes these dates, who embraces the terms and conditions of the covenant, the first of which is to walk away from your country, the second of which is to rely wholeheartedly on Yahweh, then you will receive each of those benefits. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. You can join in this discussion by calling 877-300-7645. So while there are obviously 6,000-year epics in Yah's creation account, God's plan flows in fourth in increments of 40 yovels, or 2,000 years. A yovel is 50 years. It's 7 times 7 plus 1. It follows the same model as the Shavua, which is the annual meeting of 7 Sabbaths. Yobel means, excuse me, is Yah's, speaks of Yah's lamb, is what Yobel means. And so if you look at 40, which is the reoccurrent pattern of a time of testing that's used throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, for example, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. The children of Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. They were held prisoner in Egypt for 400 years. The time that they were restless at the bottom of Mount Horeb while Yahweh was revealing his Torah to Moshe was 40 days. 40 is a reoccurrent theme. 40 times 50 is 2,000 years. And so it is exactly 40 Yobel, or years of Yah's lamb, that separate Adam's expulsion from the Garden of Eden and the initiation of the covenant with Abraham, where Abraham went to Mount Moriah, which is means to revere Yah, and performed a dress rehearsal for Passover. And exactly 40 Yobel, 2,000 years, separate the establishment of the covenant on Mount Moriah with Abraham and Yahusha on the fourth day of human history from the expulsion of the garden, walking into Jerusalem and going to that very same mountain to fulfill the promise of Passover on the Moed as the sign that Yahweh was speaking about on this fourth day. Now that is 33 CE on our pagan calendars, year 4000 Yah. It was the only year during the period of time in which Passover began on Thursday at sundown. This allowed Yahusha to celebrate Passover with his disciples on Thursday evening after sunset, while at the same time being the Passover lamb on Friday before sundown, all on the same scriptural day. And all in harmony with Matanyahu's and Yahochanan's, as well as Mark's and Luke's testimony of what occurred. It is also a perfect match for the prophecies of Daniel, when he told us precisely how long from the edict to return and restore Jerusalem to the time that the Messiah would arrive. It has the Messiah arriving in Jerusalem, when you do the math, exactly 4 days before Passover, in accordance with the Torah's testimony, in year 4000 Yah, which is 33 CE, on our pagan calendars. Now, regarding Herod, here's what we know, because we have been told, particularly in the historical portrait provided by the disciple Matanyahu, that he was still king over Yehuda at the time that the Messiah arrived. Herod was half Edomite and half Arab. He had two sons through Miriam, who was one of the few surviving descendants of the Hashemites, in order to legitimize his rule. His politically inspired boys were given the Greek names Alexander and Aristobulus. However, previously Herod had fathered Antipater by way of a commoner named Doris. Jealous of Alex's and Aristo's royal genes, Antipater and Doris concocted a slanderous campaign against him, ultimately causing Herod himself, who was genetically and morally depraved, to side with the genetically and morally depraved Doris and Antipater. And he had his royal sons executed. Not pleased by the proposed act of familial vengeance, Caesar Augustus revoked Herod's killing privileges and demoted him to a subject rather than a friend status of the Roman Empire. As a result, Herod was forced to have Alexander and Aristobulus tried by Caesar's representatives in Beirut, Syria. But it was only a minor setback, because the loving the sight of blood, the Roman officials ruled against the boys and let the father kill his sons. In this sordid affair, we find confirmation of Herod's willingness to kill children, even his own, and there find affirmation with the story that is told in Matanyah. The death of Alexander and Aristobulus empowered Antipater. As a result, he became co-ruler with his father and in no way was different from a king, according to Josephus in Antiquities 17.2. This occurred in 4 BCE. Then, not yet satisfied, Antipater schemed to kill his father. But since Herod was an accomplished murderous schemer himself, he uncovered the plot and had his lone remaining heir recalled from Rome for trial. Disenfranchised, Herod, who was no longer so great, had to have the Roman governor, Varus, try the case. Then upon Antipater's conviction for treason, Herod petitioned Rome again, this time to have his remaining son executed. He prevailed. While it is assumed in scholarly circles that Herod's death was somehow contemporaneous with Aristobulus's in 4 BCE, the evidence does not concur. You see, when Varus, who ultimately, Arcadius, who ultimately succeeded Herod, and that's confirmed by Matanyah 2:22 and in history, when they assumed uncontested power, he had long exercised royal authority, according to Josephus in the Jewish Wars, Volume 2, 26, confirming that Herod lived for some time as a co-regent after the aborted 4 BCE coup. They ruled together as co-rulers, long existed royal authority. They ruled together for years after the attempted coup. In part, it was this instability in Yehuda, which means related to Yah, it's been corrupted to Judea today, which may have prompted Caesar to conduct the census and its requisite oath of allegiance to the emperor and to Rome as the lord of the world. This is what brought Joseph and Mary, Miriam and Joseph, to Bethlehem. The fact that in Yehuda, the census coincided with the Mikra of Sukkah, which in which every Yehudim who was able migrated to the outskirts of Jerusalem to camp out with God, was politically astute on the part of Augustus. By way of comparison, Caligula is recorded by Josephus in Antiquities 18.124 as having done exactly the same thing upon his ascension and the change of government. As further confirmation, Caesar noted in a 2 BCE speech on his 25th anniversary of being elevated from Octavian to the title of Augustus, and later from man to God, that he was given the title of Pater Patrae, father of the country, by the entire Roman people, which would have required an oath and a census at that time. Now, while it isn't germane to our story, the year 2 BCE wasn't only Caesar Augustus's silver jubilee. It was the 750th anniversary of the founding of Rome. We have all of this to affirm the 2 BCE date. Therefore, all one has to do is put the historical and scriptural pieces together and recognize that the full lunar eclipse recorded on January 1, 1 BCE, was the celestial event Josephus was referencing in connection with Herod's death, and not the partial eclipse in 4 BCE. The Roman census, Miriam and Joseph's migration to Bethlehem, Yosha's arrival, and Herod's subsequent persecution of newborns all fit within the historical timeline which God has attested. But there are two more wrinkles we should examine. First, more recent studies of the earliest Josephus manuscripts reveal that a copying error made in 1544 CE contributed to the errant dating of Herod's demise. Corrected to the oldest manuscripts, we learn that the capture of Jerusalem occurred in late 36 CE, making January 1 CE the 34th year of this despot's reign. The second issue, which requires reconciliation, is a contemporaneous governorship in Syria. Luke explains that Yahusha arrived during the reign of Caesar Augustus, who reigned from 43 BCE to 14 CE, when Quirinus was the governor of Syria. The problem here is that a cursory inspection suggests that Quirinus Vargas became procurator or governor of Syria in 6 CE. However, there are two coins which reveal that he also ruled Syria between 7 and 4 BCE and again between 2 BCE and 1 CE, which resolves the conflict. Tertullian, a reasonably trustworthy historian and lawyer, born about 160 CE, one of my favorite ancient sources. He's right far more than he is wrong, unlike most of the others at this time, stated that Augustus began his reign 41 years before the birth of Yahusha, and that the emperor died 15 years after the Messiah's redemptive advent, placing Yahusha's arrival in 2 BCE. The 42nd year of Augustus ran from the autumn of 2 BCE to the fall of 1 BCE. Tertullian also noted that the Messiah was born 28 years after, and born is really a relative term here, after the death of Cleopatra in 30 CE, which again is consistent with the 2 BCE date. Now, you might say, well, why do you care about all this stuff? What difference does it make? Well, the difference that it makes is that scholars will tell you that he arrived in 4 BCE, and they will try to move up the date of the of his fulfillment of the Mikra so that he was about 30 years old when he began his ministry, and they slide everything forward. Now, when you do that, you go in conflict with actual recorded history, you're now in conflict with the eyewitness accounts, and you're in conflict with the actual timing of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkotim. To the last segment of Shattering Myths for today. We're going over the history of the Messiah, Yahusha's arrival, as predicted in the fourth day of creation, which has him being the greater light for the purpose of being a sign revealed to us of the fulfillment of the Moed, which are the seven annual meetings each year with Yahweh, the first four of which were fulfilled precisely as the prediction of the fourth day indicated in year 4000 Yah, which was year 33 CE. When we go back in time, though, it is important that we recognize when Yahusha arrived, that it was on the Mikra of Sukkah, which means God camping out with humankind in 2 BCE, because when you do the math, you have him being approximately 30 years old when he began his ministry. There are three Passovers mentioned in his ministry, which would then coincide with the 33 CE date, which is essential, because if it wasn't 33 CE, then it was not a Yobel year. Then it was a year where the dates do not line up with the days of the week as recorded in the eyewitness accounts, and it would be that Yahweh did not fulfill his testimony. So it is important that you know the facts, so that you know that historical evidence does what it always does, which is it actually confirms the details of Yah's predictions. Moving on, we find that Irenaeus, born 75 years before Tertullian, also noted that Yahusha was born in the 41st year of Augustus's reign, which is consistent with the accounting of Scripture and with Tertullian. Eusebius, another early historian, provides corroborating testimony ascribing the advent of the Messiah to the 28th anniversary of the subjugation of Egypt by the Romans and the death of Antony and Cleopatra in the fall of 30 BCE. Most importantly, especially as it pertains to the Messiah prediction in Bereshith 1, Yohanan proclaimed that the Word became flesh and tabernacled with us, connecting his arrival with the called-out assembly of tabernacles, which is shelters, meaning God camped out with humankind. As mentioned previously in Luke's hearsay accounts, 3:23, it explains that Yahusha was around 30 when he began his ministry. The Greek text records Yahusha observing three Passovers as part of his witness, and Daniel dates the last one to April 1st, 33 CE, which is confirmed in the Masayah presentation of the book called Yada Yah. If you go to yadayah.com, you go to the Salvation volume, and the first chapter of that volume, you will find evidence that proof, detailed proof, of the prediction that Daniel made and how it it proves that Yahusha fulfilled Pesach on April 1st in 33 CE, which was the precise day that Daniel predicted many hundreds of years in advance. And all of this serves to confirm that the greater light was indeed manifest in our presence as a sign to mankind on the fourth millennia of our history post-Garden, on the Moed Mikre, as they are predicted in the not only Torah's Shemoth Exodus book, but also Kara Leviticus, and of course here now in Bereshith Genesis, all confirmed by the eyewitness and disciple Matanyahu and the disciple and eyewitness Yahochanan. As we have discovered by dissecting Bereshith, each creative day ends with a benediction. In them, time is reversed, dusk precedes dawn. Yahweh wants us to look at the creation account from his perspective, looking forward in time, not to ours looking back in time. There exists the end of the day, which is Ereb, evening, darkness, the mixed together of interwoven fabrics of life, mingling and joining things together, and the beginning of the day, Bokor, morning or sunrise, from Bakar, to seek, to search, to inquire, and to consider the light, existing as the fourth period of time, the fourth Yom day, Bereshith, in the beginning, Genesis 1:19. More than any day, the fourth epoch of creation serves as a lesson to me personally. Several years ago, I invested a month trying to reconcile its accounting with the observable evidence. While researching Islam, I considered a number of scholarly tomes written by atheists. In one of them, the author tried to be even-handed, assaulting the biblical creation account with the same veracity he did Allah's laughable tale. The atheist point of attack was twofold, and we will consider it when Shattering Myths returns in its second hour tomorrow, where he will make the claim that God's Torah account says that the sun was created after life began to flourish on the earth. He was wrong. I am Yada. This has been Shattering Myths.
You've come to expect winter specials from Herbal Healer Academy, and we're not going to let you down. Battle through cold and flu season with powerful, natural, and safe flu fighters.